Okay, let's unpack this. You might think of drug development as this relentless, continuous march forward, you know, a never-ending pursuit of new cures and treatments.
Right.
And in many ways, that heroic effort is constant. But beneath the surface, like any vital sector, it experiences distinct cycles, its own seasons, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into something absolutely fascinating and incredibly critical.
Mm.
The contract research organization, or CRO, industry, and the broader biotech R&D sector.
Indeed. We're looking at what's been starkly termed the biotech winter, a period of significant challenge, a real chill in the air for innovation that, well, maybe few saw coming quite like this.
Yeah.
But crucially, we'll also examine the emerging signs of a thaw, those elusive, you know, green shoots, and what that signals for the future of medical innovation, and perhaps for your understanding of this vital, often hidden part of the global economy.
Our mission today is to cut through the noise, right? To distill the most important nuggets of knowledge from a stack of compelling sources.
Yep.
We've got detailed sector analyses, the very latest market reports, and granular company earnings. We'll help you understand not just what is happening, but why it matters and where things might be headed.
Because gaining knowledge quickly but thoroughly.
And getting those aha moments.
Right. That's really what this deep dive is all about.
So let's start by understanding the landscape. Imagine a vast, innovative ecosystem vital to our health suddenly plunged into an unexpected deep freeze. That's the biotech winter.
Mm-hmm.
But how did a sector, seemingly always on the cusp of breakthrough, find itself in such a chilling period? And, well, what does it tell us about the hidden mechanics of innovation?
What's truly fascinating here is how directly the current cyclical downturn in the CRO industry is linked to a severe contraction in biotech funding.
Okay.
This wasn't just a minor blip on the radar. It was a profound, fundamental, great R&D reset that dramatically shifted the sector starting in 2022 and has truly persisted right through the first half of 2025. And the core of this seismic shift lies in a major macroeconomic change. The abrupt end of the zero interest rate policy, or ZRRP era.
ZRRP.
Right.
Right. That was a cornerstone of the economic landscape for so long. It feels like a lifetime ago, almost. How did that specifically inflate valuations in biotech, and why did its sudden end cause such a reset?
Well, during the ZRRP era, with interest rates hovering near zero, investors were, in a way, forced to chase higher risk assets to find any meaningful return.
Right. Nowhere else to go.
Exactly. This environment created what Wall Street called the there is no alternative, or TINA, trade. Biotech, particularly early stage companies, you know, the ones still in preclinical development or very early clinical trials.
Really long shot bets.
Looked incredibly attractive because with rates so low, the future cash flows often decades away were discounted at extremely low rates.
Oh, okay.
This mathematically inflated their valuations. Think of it like a distant treasure chest. If you don't discount its future value much, it seems worth a lot today.
Makes sense.
So when the Federal Reserve began aggressively raising interest rates in 2022, that treasure chest suddenly got much further away, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
The discount rate for those far-off future cash flows increased significantly. This wasn't just about investor sentiment cooling off. It was a mathematical reality.
Just pure math.
It disproportionately compressed the valuations of biotech companies, especially those without near-term revenue. And with safer assets now offering positive, tangible returns, the incentive for investors to fund highly speculative, cash-burning biotechs just diminished sharply.
The TINA trade was over.
It was over. And this led to a pronounced shift in venture capital, or VC, risk appetite, favoring de-risked later-stage companies that had a clearer, shorter path to commercialization and profitability.
So if the cost of money changed so dramatically, painting a stark picture of shifting valuations, what did that mean for the actual dollars flowing into these companies? Could we see this monetary policy shift reflected directly in the funding numbers?
Oh, absolutely. You can see it plain as day. The flow of capital into biopharma peaked spectacularly in 2021. That was a truly frothy period.
I remember.
And while 2024 did see a notable recovery in overall funding, reaching $102 billion, which is actually a 10-year high if you exclude the pandemic anomalies, this momentum, unfortunately, just didn't carry into 2025. In fact, the first half of 2025 became a story of reversal. In Q2 2025, overall venture capital funding for biotechs plummeted sequentially from $7.0 billion in Q1 down to $4.8 billion.
That's a big drop.
Huge. And to put that in perspective, that tied for the worst quarterly total in the last 3 years. That really underscores the fragility and ongoing pressure in the funding environment. It's still very tight out there.
And what about the traditional pathways for companies to raise significant capital, like going public, the IPO market? How are they impacted by this chill?
That's a critical choke point, a real bottleneck for the industry. The IPO window, which is such a vital source of capital for later stage companies and, you know, a crucial exit mechanism for early investors.
Yeah, how VCs get their money back.
Exactly. It's been effectively slammed shut. To give you some perspective, only 5 biotech companies managed to go public in the entire first half of 2025.
5. Compared to...
Or to the boom years of 2020 and 2021, when approximately 150 companies were listing.
Wow. Okay. That's stark.
Investor appetite has been absolutely crushed by the poor post-listing performance of these companies. The vast majority of biotech IPOs since 2024 are trading well below their offering prices.
So it's a negative feedback loop.
Precisely. It deters new listings, but it also traps capital within private companies. For instance, in Q2 2025, IPO proceeds plummeted to a mere $0.9
billion. $0.9
billion. Yeah. This isn't just a number. It's a stark illustration of the capital markets tightening up significantly, leaving many promising companies just stuck in a holding pattern.
Beyond the immediate financial squeeze, were there other, perhaps less obvious, pressures piling onto biotech companies, making this winter even harsher?
Absolutely. Yeah, compounding the funding issues were very direct operational cost pressures stemming from broader inflation across the economy.
Right. Everything got more expensive.
Exactly. The cost of conducting clinical trials has been steadily rising, and it's not just about the raw materials or logistics, though those are certainly factors. It's critically about skilled labor.
People.
We're seeing a global shortage of highly qualified clinical research associates, or CRAs, and other specialized personnel. This shortage exacerbates wage inflation. It acts as a direct restraint on CRO margins because these are the people who actually run the trials.
You can't run a trial without them.
You can't. And projections suggest that overall pharmacy spend is actually going to continue to climb by about 3.8% through mid-2026.
So no relief in sight there.
It signals that these persistent cost pressures within the broader healthcare ecosystem aren't going away anytime soon, adding another layer of complexity for companies trying to advance R&D.
So it's a squeeze from both sides.
It really is. Less funding coming in and rising operational costs going out.
So with this funding winter chilling the biotech sector, what was the direct impact on the contract research organizations themselves, the CROs? Were all players affected equally, or did some manage to weather the storm better than others? It sounds like, you know, in times of stress, the market is choosing scale and diversification above all else.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the impact was certainly not uniform across the CRO landscape. You've hit on a crucial point there. We saw a very clear bifurcation.
Bifurcation, okay.
Yeah, a separation, a true divide between the diversified, skilled leaders who managed to weather the storm with greater resilience, and then the more specialized players who bore the full brunt of biotech's financial constraints.
Makes sense.
This flight to quality among sponsors, meaning the pharmaceutical and biotech companies that outsource their research, is fundamentally reshaping the competitive landscape of the CRO industry itself.
So it's changing the industry structure.
Definitely. It's a powerful signal to any company in this space. Adapt or risk being left behind.
Can you give us some specific examples of this bifurcated reality in their Q2 2025 financial results? I'm curious how this plays out in the numbers.
Absolutely. When we look at the Q2 2025 financial results, the pressure on top-line growth becomes very evident, and the contrast is stark. Let's take IQVIA.
Okay, the big one.
Arguably the industry's largest and most diversified player. They reported overall revenue growth of 5.3%. Now, within that, their core research and development solutions, or R&DS segment, that's where a lot of the clinical trial work happens.
Right.
It grew by a modest 2.5% or even less at 1.3% constant currency.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is key, IQVIA has a highly diversified model.
The TAS segment, right?
Exactly. The technology and analytics solutions, or TAS segment. This provided significant resilience, helping to offset the clinical downturn because TAS is less tied to the volatile biotech funding cycle.
Okay, so that diversification helped.
Big time. Great. Now, in stark contrast, you look at ICON. They're a more traditional, pure-play clinical CRO.
Right.
They reported a year-over-year revenue decline of 4.8% for the same period. Hmm. Yeah. It highlights the inherent risks of a less diversified model in this challenging environment. And then looking at Charles River Labs, or CRL, they're kind of a bellwether for the preclinical market.
The very early stage stuff.
Exactly. Consensus estimates actually projected a substantial 10.7% year-over-year decline in their Q2 earnings per share. That reflects the direct impact of reduced early-stage R&D spending from their biotech clients who are feeling that financial squeeze.
That's a stark difference in performance. Really shows that divide. How did these pressures manifest in forward-looking indicators, like new business bookings and their project backlogs? You know, the stuff that gives us a sense of future demand.
Yeah, that's the next important question, right? What does the future look like? And here, too, we saw early signs of stabilization, but with significant divergence. IQVIA again demonstrated notable strength in Q2.
Okay.
They posted a healthy net book-to-bill ratio of 1.12x.
Meaning they booked more new business than they recognized in revenue.
Exactly. $1.12 of new business for every $1 of revenue recognized. That's a very positive sign. They also grew their industry-leading backlog to a record $32.1
billion. $32 billion, wow.
Which was up 5.1% year-over-year. So that provides a strong revenue base for the future. Most importantly, their management commentary highlighted a meaningful uptick in demand.
Hello, so?
With Request for Proposal, or RFP, flow ta. That's when clients ask CROs to bid on new projects growing in the low teens year-over-year in Q2 2025.
Low teens growth in RFPs. That sounds good.
It's really good. And importantly, driven by all customer segments. That's a powerful signal of broad-based demand possibly returning.
And how did that compare to Icon and Charles River Labs, who seem to be facing more headwinds?
Well, in contrast, Icon posted a weaker net book-to-bill ratio of 1.02x.
Barely above one.
Yeah. While their gross bookings did show some sequential improvement, the net figure was significantly weighed down by elevated contract cancellations. We'll talk more about that. For the preclinical segment, Charles River Labs provided a cautiously positive signal back in Q1 2025. Their Discovery and Safety Assessment, or DSA, segment's net book-to-bill ratio actually returned to above 1.0x for the first time in over 2 years.
Okay, so maybe a bottoming there.
A small but important sign of stabilization, yeah. Suggesting early stage demand might be turning a corner for them, at least.
You mentioned contract cancellations significantly weighing on Icon. What exactly was the cancellation conundrum, as it's been called, and what does it tell us about the broader industry health?
Right, the cancellation conundrum. It's a critical point that really exposes risk concentration. Icon's Q2 performance was materially impacted by the cancellation of a single, very large next-generation COVID vaccine trial.
One trial.
Think of it like a giant anchor dropped on their net bookings. This wasn't just a minor setback. It significantly reduced their net bookings and highlighted a real risk concentration within their backlog.
Shows how vulnerable they can be.
Even large players, yeah. It shows how vulnerable they can be to a single client or project, especially a large one. Their management expects these elevated cancellation levels to persist in the near term.
Oh, really?
Which suggests that the clients are continuing to reprioritize their portfolios and are still facing financial distress.
So the pain isn't over for everyone?
Not yet. It means that while some signs of demand are stabilizing, the existing project pipeline is still being scrutinized and cut back by clients feeling the pinch. So monitoring this cancellation metric across the entire industry will be absolutely crucial to accurately gauging the overall health and the pace of recovery.
So that's the obvious takeaway. Diversification seems key. But is it always that simple? I mean, could focusing on a niche, even a distressed one, yield outsized returns if you pick the right horse in a recovery? Or does having diverse clients, not just relying on a few, make an undeniable difference in this challenging environment?
That's a perceptive question. And while need specialization can indeed offer outsized returns during a boom.
Right, when everything's going up.
The downturn unequivocally underscores the strategic importance of a diversified client base for CROs in times of stress. Those with a balanced mix between large, well-capitalized pharmaceutical companies and smaller emerging biotechs are proving far more resilient.
Yeah.
Large pharma, while certainly managing its own budgets, generally has more stable, predictable R&D spending patterns compared to the SMID cap biotech segment that's small and mid-cap biotech.
Which rely on that VC funding we talked about.
Exactly. Which, as we've discussed, is almost entirely dependent on those notoriously volatile capital markets for funding. This bifurcation in client health is a primary driver of the performance gap we're seeing between different CROs.
So diversification is more defensive.
While a niche player might hit a home run if their specific area gets a surge of funding, the diversified players offer a much more stable and predictable ride through the downturns. It smooths things out.
So the biotech funding winter is certainly an acute problem, hitting a specific part of the market hard. But what about the bigger players, the large pharmaceutical companies? Are they also pulling back on R&D, or is there a different dynamic at play that could actually benefit CROs, perhaps even creating a long-term tailwind?
This is where it gets really interesting, because large pharma actually provides a crucial, stabilizing long-term tailwind for the CRO industry, even as they scrutinize their own costs.
How so?
Big Pharma is navigating a profound paradox. They need to manage costs in an uncertain macroeconomic environment while simultaneously confronting a historic patent cliff that necessitates aggressive pipeline replenishment.
A patent cliff. That sounds like a ticking time bomb for their revenue. Can you just paint a picture for us? How dire is that situation, and how does it fundamentally force their hand with companies like CROs?
It's not just a ticking time bomb. It's a colossal challenge. The pharmaceutical industry is facing an unprecedented wave of patent expirations starting really soon. We're talking about an estimated $350 billion in revenue that is at risk from patent expirations between 2025 and 2029.
$350 billion.
Billion, with a B. To put that in perspective, that's roughly a quarter of their current global revenue potentially eroding in just a handful of years.
That's huge.
It's an enormous revenue gap, and it's simply too large to fill solely through internal R&D, and here's why that's a problem.
Their own labs can't make it up.
Not entirely. The internal rate of return on R&D investment for large biopharma has actually fallen to a mere 4.1%.
4%? That's low.
To put that in context, that's well below their cost of capital. So from a purely financial standpoint, making large speculative internal R&D investments is less attractive.
Right.
This dynamic forces a fundamental strategic shift for Big Pharma. They're moving towards a buy over build framework.
Buy versus build.
Okay. This means external innovation acquired through mergers and acquisitions or M&A and licensing deals becomes absolutely essential to supplement their internal efforts. They need to acquire innovation, not just develop it all from scratch.
So even if they're cautious with their own budgets, this buy strategy means they still desperately need outside help from CROs and other external partners. It sounds like they're essentially outsourcing a core part of their future.
Exactly. This reliance on external innovation strongly reinforces the structural trend of R&D outsourcing. Even as pharma scrutinizes internal budgets, outsourcing to CROs and CDMOs, that's contract development and manufacturing organizations,
manufacturers,
provides critical flexibility, access to highly specialized expertise they might not have internally, and significant cost efficiencies.
They can scale up and down.
Exactly. Without the fixed overheads. The data is clear on this. From 2014 to 2022, spending on CROs and CDMOs grew at an annual rate of 12% to 13%.
That's fast growth.
It's significantly outpacing the 7% to 8% annual growth in overall R&D spending across the industry. And looking ahead, a recent McKinsey survey found that over 80% of pharma leaders expect this trend to accelerate even further.
Wow.
They're projecting a 10% to 30% rise in supplier spending over the next 5 years. This structural tailwind provides a resilient floor for CRO demand, mitigating some of the cyclical pressures from the biotech segment.
That was a long-term shift.
It's a long-term strategic shift that favors the outsourcing partners, definitely.
And how does M&A activity where these big pharma companies are buying up smaller biotechs fit into this picture? Is it just about acquiring new drugs, or does it have a broader systemic impact on the entire R&D ecosystem beyond just the companies involved?
Oh, M&A activity is a critical leading indicator for the health of the entire R&D ecosystem. It goes well beyond just acquiring new drugs.
Okay.
The first half of 2025 saw remarkably robust deal making, which is highly significant given the environment. We've seen several multi-billion dollar transactions.
Like what?
Like Johnson & Johnson's substantial $14.6 billion acquisition of Intracellular Therapies and Merck KGaA's $3.9 billion deal for SpringWorks Therapeutics.
Those are big numbers.
Huge. These deals are crucial because they provide a vital infusion of non-dilutive capital to the acquired biotech companies, meaning they get cash without having to issue more shares and dilute existing investors.
More for them.
But more importantly, they return capital to the venture capital backers who initially funded these innovative biotechs.
Ah, the VCs get paid.
Right. This liquidity allows VCs to realize returns on their investments and then redeploy that capital into new early-stage ventures. It effectively restarts the entire funding cycle that ultimately fuels the growth of CROs and the broader R&D pipeline.
So M&A primes the pump.
It's like a financial circulatory system, and M&A gets the blood flowing again.
Exactly.
So, despite all the challenges we've discussed, a recovery seems inevitable because developing life-saving medicines isn't discretionary, is it? It's a fundamental human need.
Right. The question isn't if, but when. How can we spot the signs of this recovery? What are the tea leaves we should be reading to understand when this winter truly begins to thaw?
Yeah, this raises the important question. What signals a definitive turn in the cycle? Monitoring a specific interconnected set of metrics will be absolutely crucial for tracking the recovery's progress.
Like a dashboard.
Exactly. Think of it as a leading indicators dashboard, a series of gauges that collectively tell us the climate is changing.
Okay, so what's the very first signal we should be looking for? The earliest indicator that the chill is starting to break?
The earliest signal will come from the biotech funding pipeline itself, specifically within the private markets. We need to look for a sustained increase in both the volume and value of early-stage financing rounds that seed and Series A rounds.
The very beginning of the pipeline.
Precisely. This would indicate a genuine thawing of venture capital risk appetite. While venture funds collectively hold a record level of what's called dry powder, uninvested capital, exceeding $310 billion.
That's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines.
It is, but the pace of its deployment has been notably sluggish. It's like having a full tank of gas but driving very slowly.
Right.
An acceleration in this deployment rate, coupled with a stabilization or, ideally, an increase in pre-money valuations for these early-stage companies, would truly be the first green shoot of a recovery.
So VCs opening their wallets again.
It means VCs are starting to put their money to work again in riskier, earlier stage ventures. That's the first sign.
And once that funding starts flowing, what's the next direct measure of R&D spending, indicating that money is actually being deployed into drug development?
The next step is clinical trial activity. An increase in funding will directly translate into more R&D work being initiated.
Makes sense.
We should closely track new clinical trial starts on registries like clinicaltrials.gov, paying particular attention to phase 1 and 2 studies.
Early phase trials.
Yeah, these are direct measures of early stage biotech R&D spend, which often rely heavily on CROs. After trial initiations return to pre-pandemic levels in 2024, with about 5,300 new studies. A sustained year-over-year increase through 2025 would confirm that new capital is actively being put to work and new research is truly getting off the ground.
What kind of areas?
We expect areas like oncology, CNS disorders, and cardiovascular diseases to continue leading in trial volume.
Okay. What about the most direct indicators for the CRO industry specifically? How do they gauge their own future workload?
Right. For the CROs themselves, the most direct forward-looking indicator is request for proposal. Or RFP volume.
The bids for new work.
Exactly. This is where clients ask CROs to bid on new projects. IQVIA's reported low teens year-over-year growth in Q2 RFP flow is truly the most significant positive data point to emerge thus far in the space.
A low teens number again.
It tells us that companies are planning new studies. Confirmation of this trend from other major CROs in their upcoming earnings reports would signal a broad-based recovery in demand across the industry.
So we need to see others confirm it.
Yes. Furthermore, a sustained period of industry-wide net book-to-bill ratios consistently above, say, 1.2x would mark a definitive inflection point.
Moving beyond just stability.
Right. Moving from mere stabilization to actual expansion. That 1.2x figure means they're booking 20% more new business than they're completing, showing healthy growth in their order books.
And finally, what role does the regulatory environment, specifically the FDA, play in all of this? Does their pace of approvals influence investor confidence?
A stable and predictable regulatory landscape is absolutely essential for maintaining investor confidence in the sector. It de-risks the path to market, right?
Yeah.
Key metrics here include the number of FDA novel drug approvals and the issuance of breakthrough therapy designations.
Those speed things up.
Yeah, these designations signal that the FDA views a drug as a significant advance, often expediting its review. In the first half of 2025, the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, or CDER, approved 16 novel drugs.
16. How's that compared to before?
It's pacing slightly behind 2024, But a steady or accelerating pace of approvals, especially for truly innovative therapies, provides a very positive backdrop for continued investment. It signals the overall health of the pipeline.
Tells investors the science is still working.
Exactly. It tells investors that the scientific progress is translating into tangible new medicines.
Those are the signals that tell us the thaw is happening. But what are the big drivers, the powerful forces, that will kick this recovery into high gear and truly pull the sector out of the winter?
Okay, so the drivers. There are three primary catalysts expected to drive the cyclical rebound we're anticipating. The most impactful, the when not if catalyst, is a definitive shift to a more accommodative monetary policy by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
The Fed pivot.
A reduction in the federal funds rate will lower the cost of capital across the entire economy. This has a dual benefit for biotech.
Dr. Worley.
One, it directly boosts valuations by lowering the discount rate applied to those long-duration future earnings, making them look more attractive again.
The math changes back.
Right. And two, it encourages a broader risk-on sentiment among investors, driving capital flows back into growth-oriented sectors like biotech.
Money moves back into riskier assets.
Exactly. Historically, analysis shows that the biotech sector has, on average, outperformed the S&P 500 by a significant 16% in the 12 months following the very first rate cut in a new cycle.
16% outperformance. That's significant.
It really is. It's like turning up the thermostat on the entire economy for this sector.
So the Fed cutting rates is key. What's the next major catalyst, something internal to the industry?
The second is pharma M&A acting as a funding engine. We talked about this a bit. The strategic imperative for large pharma to address that massive 2025-2030 patent cliff through acquisitions is a powerful secondary catalyst.
They have to buy growth.
They have to. The robust M&A activity we've already seen in the first half of 2025 with those multi-billion dollar deals is expected to continue. These acquisitions provide a crucial source of non-dilutive funding for the biotech ecosystem.
Right. Cash without giving up equity.
And each deal not only validates the acquired technology, but critically returns significant capital to venture capital investors.
The virtuous cycle again.
That liquidity allows VCs to realize returns and then redeploy that capital into new companies, creating that powerful virtuous cycle of innovation and funding that fuels the entire R&D pipeline. It's the engine that refuels the early stage ecosystem.
And what's the third catalyst, perhaps the most exciting one for patients and the public?
Yeah.
You know, the promise of entirely new ways to treat disease.
Right. The third catalyst is breakthrough innovation itself. Sentiment in the biotech sector is highly sensitive to positive clinical trial news.
Good news drives excitement.
Definitely. A major drug approval or compelling positive late-stage data in a high-value therapeutic area can rapidly reignite investor enthusiasm and attract generalist capital back into the sector. It demonstrates the tangible potential.
What areas should we watch?
Key areas to watch for such catalysts include next-generation oncology treatments like antibody-drug conjugates, or ADCs, and cutting-edge cell therapies. Also, novel approaches in CNS disorders such as Alzheimer's disease and significant advances in rare disease treatments.
Is unmet needs there?
Huge. These scientific and clinical milestones can be transformative, not just for patients, but for market sentiment, proving that the R&D machine is still capable of generating incredible value.
And how quickly might all of this play out? Are we talking months or years for this recovery to truly take hold? I mean, can these smaller biotechs really hold out that long, or are we just pushing the problem further down the road if it's a slow thaw?
That's a critical point, and it's why a higher for longer rate policy is such a bear case scenario for so many of these companies. The timing and pace of the recovery will fundamentally depend on the interplay and speed of these catalysts.
Okay.
We can consider three scenarios, each with a different probability.
Yeah.
Our base case, which we assign about a 60% probability.
The most likely outcome.
Right. It envisions a gradual recovery unfolding over, say, 24 to 36 months, beginning in the second half of 2026.
Okay. Still a ways off.
This is contingent on the Federal Reserve initiating rate cuts in late 2025 or early 2026. In this scenario, venture capital funding would gradually thaw throughout 2026.
Slowly defrosting.
Leading to a modest pickup in phase I-II trial starts in the latter half of the year, the IPO window would begin to crack open slowly for high-quality later-stage companies.
Not a floodgate opening.
No. For CROs, revenue growth would likely bottom out sometime in 2026 and then reaccelerate to mid-single digits in 2027. We project the Fed funds rate target may be decreasing to 3.75-4.00% by Q4 2026, biotech VC funding increasing to maybe $11 billion per quarter by that time, and average CRO book-to-bill steadily increasing to 1.30x.
So a gradual climb.
It's a slow, steady climb out of the hole. That's the base case.
What about a more optimistic or pessimistic outlook? What would accelerate or prolong this winter?
Okay, the best case. We assign this maybe a 25% probability. This posits a V-shaped recovery happening much faster, maybe within 12 to 18 months.
That would be nice.
The scenario is spurred by earlier than expected aggressive rate cuts by the Fed, maybe starting in the second half of 2025, combined with a sustained surge in large-scale pharma M&A.
Everything goes right.
Pretty much. This would lead to a rapid reopening of the biotech IPO window by mid-2026. Under this optimistic scenario, CRO book-to-bill ratios would consistently exceed 1.3x by the end of 2026, with revenue growth reaccelerating rapidly in the first half of 2027. This would be the hot summer after a very cold winter.
Okay, and the downside?
On the other end, the bear case. We give this a 15% probability. This predicts an extended downturn lasting maybe 3 to 5 years.
Oof.
This would occur if inflation remains stubbornly high, forcing the Fed to maintain a higher for longer interest rate policy through 2026, continuing to starve the sector of cheap capital.
A prolonged freeze.
Such a scenario would lead to a significant number of biotech company failures, a structural downsizing of the industry. CROs would face multiple years of flat to low single-digit growth, intense pricing pressure, and severe margin compression. Many promising therapies might simply never make it out of the lab in that scenario.
That's a sobering thought. This is certainly a complex picture of challenges and potential recovery. Given this volatility, how should one approach investing in this sector? Is it truly a flight to quality, as some suggests? Or are there hidden gems that might surprise us in a rebound?
Absolutely. It necessitates a very discerning approach. A clear hierarchy has certainly emerged, unequivocally favoring scaled, highly diversified players that have demonstrated resilience.
The big guy.
The market is definitely prioritizing stability right now. Let's look at the large cap leaders first.
Starting with IQVIA, which you mentioned as a strong player with good diversification, you rate them overweight.
Indeed. We assign an overweight rating to IQVIA. Our investment thesis for them is centered on their best-in-class diversification and technology leadership. They have that unique structure, right? With the two powerful synergistic segments, R&DS, the core clinical business,
MTAS,
and technology and analytics solutions, TAS. The TAS segment, which provides data, analytics, real-world evidence services, is a high-growth, high-margin business that's far less correlated with the biotech funding cycle.
More stable.
It's driven more by the commercialization needs of large pharma, providing a stable engine of growth that crucially buffers the cyclicality of the clinical R&D business. This was very evident in Q2 2025, where TAS revenue grew a robust 8.9% year over year, significantly offsetting the more modest 2.5% growth in R&DS.
So the model works.
It does. Furthermore, IQVIA's aggressive investment in AI and data platforms is not just talk. It's a core strategy to enhance efficiency and create a strong competitive moat. Their forward-looking indicators for the core clinical business are strong. That Q2 book-to-bill of 1.1x, the record $32.1 billion backlog, coupled with management's report of low teens year-over-year growth in RFP flow.
All pointing up.
It signals an inflection point. Now, it trades at a premium valuation, around 11.8 times its forward EBITDA, that's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
A common valuation metric.
Yeah. But we believe that premium is well-earned and justified by its superior, more resilient business model. We see an implied upside of about 21% to our price target of $235.
Okay. What about Thermo Fisher, particularly its PPD segment? You have the market weight. How does its broader exposure influence its investment profile in this context?
Right. Thermo Fisher, specifically its PPD segment, carries a market weight rating. The investment case here is built on the unparalleled scale and synergy created by the integration of PPD into the broader Thermo Fisher ecosystem.
They bought PPD.
Exactly. This combination offers a unique end-to-end solution spanning life sciences, tools, diagnostics, clinical trial services, and contract manufacturing. Their accelerator drug development solution, which integrates CDMO and CRO capabilities, has been shown to significantly shorten development timelines for clients by streamlining processes.
The efficiency gains.
Their Q2 2025 results were strong, overall revenue of $10.85 billion beat estimates, and they raised full-year guidance. The pharma and biotech segment was a key growth driver, delivering mid-single-digit growth.
Wow.
However, its premium valuation, around 16.5 times forward EBITDA, reflects these strengths. The broader Thermo Fisher entity is also exposed to macroeconomic headwinds in other segments, like slowing academic research funding, which could temper overall growth.
So it's not a pure play.
Exactly. So while solid, its valuation appears to fairly balance its strong competitive position and wider exposure, warranting a market weight rating with a modest 0.2% implied upside to our $480 price target.
Okay. And on the other end of the spectrum, Charles River Labs and ICON, you have them as underweight. What's driving that cautious stance?
Both Charles River Labs, or CRL, and ICON Pelk are initiated with underweight ratings. CRL hold a dominant position in preclinical CRO and research models.
The animal studies, et cetera.
Right, which makes it highly sensitive to the earliest and most volatile stage of the R&D funding cycle, often the first area to see cuts when biotech funding dries up.
First in, first out, kinda.
Sort of. Analysts are forecasting that significant 10.7% year-over-year decline in their Q2 2025 earnings per share, reflecting this direct pressure. While their Q1 showed some demand stabilization with the DSA segment's book-to-bill recovering above 1.0x.
Quick glimmer of hope.
Lingering concerns about the global supply chain for non-human primates, which are absolutely critical for preclinical safety testing, persist, adding another layer of risk and cost. Also, weakness in their manufacturing solutions segment is a drag.
So multiple headwinds.
Yeah. Its current valuation, around 11.5 times forward EBITDA, does not appear to fully discount the potential for a prolonged period of cautious spending from its core biotech client base. We see a 5.0% implied downside to our $160 price target.
And ICON, still way down by cancellations.
As for ICON, yeah, its Q2 2025 results were disappointing. That 4.8% year-over-year revenue decline, coupled with the weak net book-to-bill of 1.02x.
Still feeling that big cancellation.
It was materially impacted by elevated contract cancellations, including that single, very large COVID vaccine trial we discussed. It shows the risk of concentration. Management expects these elevated cancellations to persist in the near term.
Still.
Suggesting ongoing client financial distress and portfolio reprioritization. While it trades at a discount to peers, around 9.5 times forward of EBITDA, the near-term risks to revenue and earnings are elevated until there is clearer evidence of normalization in cancellations and a sustainable recovery. This yields only a 0.6% implied upside to our $165 price target, making it an underweight for now.
So those are the large players. What about the mid-cap specialists? Are there opportunities there for those who might be more nimble or focused? Medpace, for example, market weight.
Among the mid-cap specialists, Medpace, or MEDP, stands out. Yes, we rate it market weight. Medpace delivered an exceptionally strong second quarter. Revenue up 14.2% year-over-year, soundly beating estimates.
Stock jumped huge, right?
Yeah, catalyzed a stock surge of over 50%. This impressive growth was driven by a strategic mix shift towards faster-burning therapeutic areas, like metabolic studies, and away from longer-cycle oncology trials, plus fewer project cancellations compared to some peers.
So they navigated it well.
Very well. Their differentiated physician-led model and disciplined operational focus have allowed them to maintain industry-leading margins, around 21.6% EBITDA margin in Q2. Management significantly raised its full-year 2025 guidance.
So why just market weight?
Well, while Medpace's high growth profile and focus on the innovative SMID-cap biotech segment make it a prime beneficiary of an eventual market recovery, its stock price now largely reflects this optimism.
The good news is priced in.
After the dramatic re-rating, the risk-reward profile appears balanced, justifying a market weight rating. There's only about 0.5% implied upside to our $480 price target, and it's trading at a higher forward EBITDA of 23.1x, reflecting that growth premium.
Okay, and Syneos Health, they went private.
Right. As for Syneos Health, yes, currently not rated, as it was acquired and taken private by private equity in September 2023. Prior to that, its biopharmaceutical acceleration model, integrating clinical development and commercialization, was a key differentiator. While no longer public, its strategic actions under private ownership will still influence market dynamics.
Okay. Beyond the CROs themselves, what about the biotech companies that will thrive in a recovery? And the specific technologies enabling the next wave of R&D. How should one think about positioning for that, knowing that capital won't just flow indiscriminately?
Excellent point. As the funding environment improves, capital certainly won't flow indiscriminately. It will be highly selective. Investors will prioritize companies with clear value propositions and reduced risk profiles.
So where do you look first?
First, look for well-funded, late-stage biotech companies. These are the most immediate beneficiaries because their assets are closest to key clinical milestones or commercial launch.
Less risk, shorter time to revenue.
Exactly. They have a shorter path to generating revenue and are less dependent on volatile early-stage funding. Think about companies with positive Phase 3 data in 2025, like Boehringer Ingelheim's zongertinib for HR2 mutant lung cancer, or nerandomilast for pulmonary fibrosis. These exemplify the type of late-stage assets that will attract significant capital and potential M&A interest.
What other types of biotech companies should be on the radar? Perhaps those with a stamp of approval from the FDA or strong industry backing?
Good question. Secondly, consider breakthrough therapy designation holders. An FDA breakthrough therapy designation is a very powerful validation signal.
It means the FDA thinks it's a big deal.
Right. It indicates that a drug has shown substantial improvement over available therapies for a serious condition, which can significantly expedite development and review timelines. It effectively de-risks the asset and makes it more attractive.
Any examples?
Companies like Avinity Biosciences, which received this for Delzota in Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or Revolution Medicines for elironrasib in KRAS G12C non-small cell lung cancer, represent high-impact innovation and are attractive targets.
Okay, what else?
Thirdly, companies with strong big pharma partnerships are key. These collaborations often provide non-dilutive funding, external scientific validation, and access to vast development and commercial expertise, all of which reduce financial risk and increase the probability of success.
Big brother helping out.
Kind of. Finally, look for companies trading below cash with quality assets.
Trading below cash. How does that happen?
During market downturns, a subset of companies can trade at a market capitalization below their net cash on the balance sheet. It sounds crazy, but it happens. This creates a compelling deep value opportunity if the company possesses a quality clinical pipeline. Any positive clinical news can lead to a significant re-rating of the stock. It's like finding a valuable asset on sale simply because of market sentiment.
Interesting. So beyond the companies themselves, what about the technological advancements that will reshape R&D? Where are the thematic opportunities for new innovation?
Right, the tech enablers. The next cycle of R&D investment will be heavily influenced by technology, creating significant opportunities in the subsectors that provide the tools for more efficient drug development. One major area is AI-driven drug discovery.
AI is everywhere.
And for good reason here. The market for AI in drug discovery is poised for explosive growth. Forecasts project a compound annual growth rate of over 27% to 37% through 2030.
Huge growth.
Imagine the efficiency gains. AI and machine learning platforms accelerate target identification, design novel molecules, and even predict clinical success. This truly transforms the economics of early stage R&D.
How so?
Because these technologies can drastically reduce timelines and failure rates, making them a critical area of investment for both pharmaceutical companies and venture capital funds. It's moving from guesswork to highly informed precision.
Okay, AI is one. What's another big tech theme? Yeah.
The second major thematic opportunity lies in clinical trial management and decentralization. The inclusion of decentralized clinical trials, or DCTs.
Running trials remotely.
Essentially, yes. It's a permanent structural shift that was significantly accelerated by the pandemic. The DCT market is expected to more than double, reaching $18.6 billion by 2030. That's a compound annual growth rate of nearly 15%.
Also, big growth. What kind of tech enables that?
This creates a massive opportunity for companies that provide the enabling technologies. We're talking about everything from wearable sensors and electronic patient-reported outcome, or EPRO, platforms, to telehealth services and the cloud-based software required to manage complex remote data streams.
Makes trials easier for patients.
These tools are absolutely essential for improving patient recruitment, enhancing data quality, and making trials more accessible and efficient for patients, especially those in remote areas or with mobility challenges.
This is certainly a sector with high potential, but also high volatility, as we've clearly seen. What are the key risks that could derail this recovery? And how might one build a resilient portfolio to navigate these dynamics, you know, protecting against the downside while capturing the upside?
Yeah, we must remain highly cognizant of significant risks, but also strategic in how we approach this. The primary downside risk to our thesis is simply an extended biotech funding winter.
the bear case we talked about.
Right. If persistent inflation forces the Fed to maintain higher for longer interest rates, it would further extend this funding winter. This would lead to a higher rate of biotech company failures, increased pressure on CRO pricing due to fierce competition, and a prolonged period of stagnant growth across the industry. It's a real pressure cooker that can't be sustained indefinitely for many companies.
And what about regulatory shifts or the very technology that's supposed to be helping the industry? Could they also pose a threat?
Absolutely. Another risk is regulatory tightening. A more stringent regulatory environment at the FDA could significantly increase the cost and complexity of drug development.
Raising the bar.
Heightened scrutiny of clinical trial data, particularly for drugs seeking accelerated approval or new requirements for trial protocol design, could raise the bar for success, dampening investor enthusiasm and slowing innovation. Then there's technology disruption itself.
The AI double-edged sword.
Exactly. While AI and automation present a huge opportunity, they also pose a disruptive threat to the traditional labor-intensive business models of some CROs. If technological adoption allows for a significant reduction in the human capital required to run clinical trials faster than incumbents can adapt, it could lead to severe margin compression for those who fail to innovate.
Gotta keep up.
Finally, don't forget global geopolitical and macroeconomic shocks. A severe global recession would obviously reduce the overall appetite for risk among investors. Furthermore, escalating geopolitical tensions, particularly those leading to new tariffs on pharmaceutical products or disruptions to the global supply chain, could introduce new costs and uncertainties into the R&D process.
So while risks are definitely present, are there also significant upside opportunities that could accelerate the recovery beyond the base case, perhaps even creating a faster return on investment?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's always upside potential, too. One opportunity is accelerated market share consolidation within the CRO industry itself.
M&A among the CROs.
Yes. A prolonged downturn could act as a catalyst for M&A. The strongest players, like IQVIA and Thermo Fisher, could leverage their robust balance sheets to acquire smaller, struggling competitors or complementary technology assets at attractive valuations.
The strong get stronger.
They would emerge from the cycle with even greater market power and an enhanced competitive moat, effectively becoming stronger from the challenge. Another factor is significant operating leverage.
Explain that.
The CRO business model inherently possesses operating leverage. As the demand environment improves and revenue growth reaccelerates, companies that have effectively managed their cost structures during the downturn will experience a rapid expansion in operating margins.
Profits grow faster than revenue,
leading to faster than expected earnings growth. It's like a coiled spring. And finally, the emergence of new therapeutic modalities.
Like cell and gene therapy.
Exactly. While the funding environment for complex modalities like cell and gene therapy is currently challenged, a scientific breakthrough in one of these areas could unlock a vast new addressable market. This would create a multi-year growth tailwind for specialized CROs with the unique expertise to support the development of these novel therapies.
So, if you're looking to invest here, what's the recommended strategy to build a resilient portfolio given these risks and opportunities? How do you balance the safe bets with the high-risk, high-reward plays?
For investors seeking to capitalize on the eventual recovery in the CRO and biotech R&D sector, a barbell strategy is highly recommended.
A barbell, okay.
This approach effectively balances the stability of established market leaders with the higher growth potential of more cyclically sensitive names and innovative biotechs.
How would you structure that?
We suggest constructing your portfolio with core holdings making up about 60% of the allocation. Here, you'd anchor the portfolio with an overweight position in IQVIA, its diversified business model, strong balance sheet, and leadership in technology and data analytics provide a defensive foundation with robust exposure to the recovery in clinical R&D. It's your anchor in the storm.
Okay, 60% core with IQVIA, and for that higher growth potential, the other end of the barbell.
For growth holdings, allocating about 25%, a market weight position in MedPace provides exposure to a higher growth, higher beta business model. Its focus on the SMID cap biotech segment means it will benefit disproportionately from a cyclical upswing in funding, as its recent stock performance has already demonstrated. It's your pure play recovery bet, but maybe a bit more volatile.
Got it. And the last 15%.
Finally, a speculative basket, making up about 15% of the portfolio. This should be a diversified group of maybe 5-7 select biotech companies.
Not putting all your eggs in one biotech basket.
Definitely not. Focus on the categories we identified earlier. Those with late-stage assets or recent breakthrough therapy designations. This allocation offers high upside potential from successful clinical development, while diversification helps to mitigate single asset risk. It's when you take more calculated risk for outsized returns.
And who to avoid or underweight.
Right. We advise a cautious stance, or an underweight avoid rating, on companies with higher direct exposure to the most distressed segments of the biotech market, or those facing specific operational headwinds. That includes Icon, Plec, and Charles River Labs for now, until there is clearer evidence of a sustained recovery in their core end markets and a resolution to their company-specific challenges.
What a deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
We've really unpacked the complexities of the biotech winter, the resilience of the CRO sector, and the intriguing signs of recovery on the horizon.
Yeah.
From the macroeconomic shifts that fundamentally alter valuations to the granular details of individual company performance and the innovative technologies shaping the future, it's clear this is a sector that's constantly adapting and evolving.
Mm.
It almost feels like a living organism sometimes.
Indeed. We've seen how external pressures like rising interest rates fundamentally reshape valuations, and how internal strategies like diversification and technology adoption determine resilience.
Hmm.
And the structural trends, like big pharma's increasing reliance on outsourcing, provide a strong underlying foundation for CRO demand, even in challenging times like the biotech winter. The non-discretionary nature of developing life-saving medicines means this sector will always find a way forward.
And it's fascinating to consider how the recovery isn't just about money, is it? It's about breakthrough innovations and strategic partnerships that fundamentally reshape how new medicines are brought to patients.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Well, the next time you hear about a new drug or a major medical breakthrough, you might just find yourself thinking about the intricate ecosystem of R&D behind it.
Yeah.
And the delicate balance of investment, innovation, and strategic adaptation that makes it all possible. Reminds me of that old saying, necessity is the mother of invention. And in biotech, economic necessity is certainly driving a lot of innovation right now.
Absolutely. The path is rarely straight, but the underlying drive to improve human health ensures its ultimate trajectory. Keep watching for those key signals we discussed. They'll tell the story.
We hope this deep dive has given you a shortcut to being well-informed, and perhaps sparked even more curiosity about the world of R&D. Until next time, keep digging deeper.